You know, I'm reminded in looking out at you and all of you about what Walter Wink calls the hidden secret of socially conscious people, social activists. And he points out one person, it could be several, but he points to Jesus of Nazareth, and he says, you know, Jesus made a point of not hanging around with what my grandmother used to call the muckety-mucks of this world, you know, the religious authorities and the civil authorities. He preferred to hang around with folks like us, or folks poorer than us. And part of it, of course, was making a teaching point, but it was mostly because he just found it a heck of a lot more fun to be with folks like us. And that was part of the reason. The other one was that he knew that with social activists, even though there were reverses back and forth, the end is assured, and it's a happy ending, and when we all kind of have the faith that we do make a difference, even though we may not be doing more than just sowing seeds right now, that makes a big difference when we're assured that the final outcome is assured. I think since what we're going to be discussing tonight is not an academic exercise, but has to do with people getting killed and the culpability of our own government in this. Now, we ought to just take a minute before we get into this and just let the profundity of this thing sink in. I mean, 2,800 plus of our young men and women killed, our troops, 655,000 Iraqi civilians dead because we started this war. 21,000 U.S. service people home, injured, many of them seriously. Let's just let that thing sink in, and let's pause for a whole minute to be quiet about that. Thank you. As I was lurking in the back, as you were filing in, two folks came in, and one looked at me and said to the other, and the other one said, "He doesn't look like a spy." This is not the first time this has happened, and I still don't know whether to be crestfallen or to be happy. I haven't figured that out. But I mentioned it because it betokens a lack of understanding what the CIA really is supposed to be all about. I'd like to take just a minute up front to tell you what that is. How else are you to know? You know, you get your idea from movies or from TV. And suffice it to say that after World War II, Harry Truman was hell-bent and determined that there would never be another Pearl Harbor. Okay? Many of you know that there were little bits of information around with the code breakers and the embassy and the Army Air Corps and the Navy. Nobody in the central place to put it all together to warn, hey, where is the Japanese fleet anyway? Hey, it looks like something's up. So he needed a central place, one person to be, well, the word is banned from the lexicon in Washington now. The word is accountable, okay? One person to be accountable for analyzing all the take, public information, classified information on a given country or subject. And that was the vision, to have that kind of thing in the Central Intelligence Agency. Equally important, and the second most thing, second and last, would be a place that could tell it like it is. You know, a place where you could go to the director and say, "Look, Mr. Director, I want you to tell me what you really think. You and those two universities worth of students, of specialists out there in the woods of Virginia, I want to know what you really think about this subject. The Air Force fellows are telling me that if we bomb North Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh's going to give up, and that they can bomb the Ho Chi Minh Trail and prevent the delivery of supplies down to the south. What do you guys think? Well, that was I used to say no-brainer, but I don't use that anymore now that Dick Cheney has adopted that term. It was an easy answer, okay? Some of the people I worked with worked in the Office of Strategic Services and literally brought Ho Chi Minh back into Hanoi after the war on their shoulders, okay? They knew how dedicated they were to have the final victory, and the one that was deprived to them by the Geneva Conference of 1954, and they knew they weren't going to give up. They also knew that the Ho Chi Minh Trail was not, you know, like I-66 or I-87, you know. It was a bunch of little footpaths with canopy that you couldn't even see it. And so we could easily tell the president, look, Mr. President, no, they're not going to give up if you bomb them, and no, you're not going to be able to interdict the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And of course, the president preferred to listen to others and was hell-bent and determined not to be the first president to lose a war, and so he disregarded our advice. Okay, now that points up another thing the president is not obliged to do or to act according to what the intelligence tells him. That will give you an idea of what it was all about. When I remember my first day at work in the CIA, new headquarters that had just been built was in the middle days of the John Kennedy administration. As I walked in there, I saw on the left-hand side of the foyer there, a big, big inscription, sort of chiseled into the marble. It said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." I looked at that, and ringing in my ears was something my Irish grandmother said to me, if not, 100 times. "Raymond, be truthful and honest, and then you won't give a damn what anyone says about you." And I thought of that as I looked at that inscription, and I said to myself, you know, Grandma, if that's true, no pun intended, this is going to be a good place to work. And it was for 27 years. It was a good place to work because I served under 9 directors, almost all of whom had the integrity to tell the president and his senior advisors the truth. Some of them got fired for that. The essential ingredient in a director is not to need the job, okay? So be able to say to the president, no, that's not right, or I quit. We haven't seen that kind of courage in a whole generation since Admiral Stansfield Turner worked for Jimmy Carter. Now, with that ethos sort of in the back of our heads and sort of not able to be eradicated, as we watched the advent of the Bush administration in 2001, we began to see some very curious things. Some of you know this, but Colin Powell very publicly in February of 2001 said, "Saddam Hussein has no weapons of mass destruction. He's not even a threat to his immediate neighbors." Condoleezza Rice, on the 29th of July 2001, said, and I quote, "We have been able to keep his weapons from him. He's not even a threat to his immediate neighbors." Well, okay, that's 6 weeks before 9/11, right? Now, you all know, because you've heard it a million times, after 9/11, everything changed. So we were being asked to believe when Rumsfeld and Cheney got up after 9/11 and said, "Saddam Hussein has chemical weapons, he's got biological weapons, he's reconstituted his nuclear program, the sky is falling, this is very serious, he's a threat not only to his immediate neighbors but to the United States of America." You know, it didn't take a rocket scientist or even a very clever analyst to smell something really rotten in Denmark, okay? It was as if we were being asked to believe that weapons of mass destruction descended from the heavens like manna right after 9/11 for a soft landing on the sands of Iraq, where God made that terrible mistake of putting our oil. It didn't parse, and so we started writing right away, and we started giving each other. When I say we, there were 5 of us initially, 5, all from CIA, 4 from the analysis department, 1 from the operation department. And we started checking each other, giving each other sanity checks. And as we saw the thing get even more complicated, we founded a movement called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And we thought maybe we could make ourselves a little more than the sum of our parts. And our first effort was on the same day that Colin Powell spoke. We set ourselves the objective of analyzing the speech and putting out a same-day critique, just as we used to do with a Khrushchev speech, or a Brezhnev speech, or a Castro speech, or a Mao Zedong speech. The same gifts, the same talents, the same techniques. Most of them called media analysis, which is sort of a highfalutin word for saying you keep track of what people say yesterday, and then you see if it changed today, and then you've got a story. So we watched what Colin Powell said, and we wrote a media critique. We coordinated it by email, and we got it out on the AFP wire at 5:15 that evening. What we told the president, it was set up just as we used to set up things for the president, memorandum for the president, from, in this case, VIPS, subject, Colin Powell's speech today before the UN. We said, Mr. President, we give him an A for performance and a C minus for content. And of course, if we knew then what we know now, we would have flunked them outright on content. We told the president that your analysts are being subjected to unconscionable pressure from your senior advisors, first and foremost, the vice president, who, as many of you know, had visited CIA headquarters 12 times to make sure that they were analyzing things right. Make sure, did you think of this, or how about this? Wasn't there a tie between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, and aren't there weapons of mass destruction? You know, as many faults as George Tenet has, and there are many, the most unconscionable was letting his young analysts be subjected to those kinds of pressure, sitting across from the Vice President of the United States, having him ask them all kinds of questions with Tenet in the back. Anyhow, that was too much, really, and so we warned the President. And in the final sentence of that critique about Powell's speech, we said to the president, look, Mr. President, we strongly advise you to broaden the circle of your advisors beyond those who are clearly bent on a war for which we see no compelling reason and from which we believe the unintended consequences are likely to be catastrophic. Oh, welcome to catastrophe, folks, because that's where we are now. We take absolutely no joy in having been right about that. There were lots of people right about that. Scott Ritter was shouting from the rooftops. He having been there, done that, he having been the UN inspector. So it was a very noxious thing having this little group of inbred advisors, many of them called neoconservatives. And that really hurts folks because, you know, I'm a conservative. To see the word conservative hijacked that way, whether it's neo or anything else, is just really painful because they are conservatives in no sense of that word. They are reckless people, and they have a reckless abandonment of the policies that they pursue. In any case, this tight circle, there are technical intelligence terms for these things, and this tight circle we call the intelligence milieu, we call them a self-licking ice cream cone. Think of the image, folks. That's what we got here. And so as we watched this, you know, we saw that our profession was being added onto by very interesting techniques. A lot of the stuff in Washington initially, and now even with the advent of the George W. Bush administration, is faith-based stuff. You know, you have faith-based this, you have faith-based that. Well, we were witnessing faith-based intelligence, which is a real kind of a new thing for us. Just to give you an idea of how much it's worth, I'm going to tell you just a little story out of my Irish heritage. There were these two Catholic nuns going home of an evening from the hospital where they worked in Belfast. And halfway back to the convent, they ran out of petrol. It was getting dark. It gets dark early in the winter in Ireland. So they trudged down to the petrol station, and they couldn't find any gas can in their car. So they took, the only thing they had in the back seat was a bedpan. So they took it down and they filled it with the gas and he came back and one nun was unscrewing the gas cap and the other nun was struggling with this unwieldy bedpan and screeches to a stop, a big limousine, one of those fancy ones with the button, you know, that you just push and the window goes down all by itself. Who is there but the Reverend Ian Paisley, Protestant leader. He looks, sizes up the situation, and he says, "Sisters, I don't agree with your religion, but I do admire your faith." Well, folks, that's what faith-based intolerance is for. What Ian thought he saw in that. The two big issues, of course, were weapons of mass destruction. And we know about that now. I used to have a spiel of 20 minutes going through a chronology showing that there weren't any and that the administration knew there weren't any. Now it's not necessary anymore. We have documentary evidence. First and foremost, in the form of the Downing Street minutes, the minutes that recorded a conversation in July of 2002, so 8 months before the war, where the head of British intelligence, Sir Richard Dearlove, gotta love those names there in British intelligence, he was sent over to deal with his counterparts in Washington and talk to US officials to find out what the president was really thinking about. Was he really gonna do a war against Iraq? Again, the 20th of July, 2002. Well, he spent the day with George Tenet and the others, among them a friend of mine. They went back and immediately on Monday morning, or Monday afternoon, I guess it was, Tony Blair convened a meeting of what I call the 12 apostles, his foreign secretary, defense secretary, his 12 most senior national security advisors, and Dearlove was asked to give a briefing. And he said, well, here it is in a nutshell, that the President of the United States has decided to do war against Iraq. This war will be justified by the conjunction of weapons of mass destruction and terrorism. Translation from the British, will say that Saddam Hussein has all manner of weapons of mass destruction and will say that he's likely to give them to terrorists. And finally, oops, wait a second, British Foreign Secretary objects. Sir Richard Dearlove, you must know that the evidence of weapons of mass destruction is very thin. I just talked to Colin Powell and, we know that 90% of those things were destroyed after Gulf War in 91. 10%, still exist on this inventory. We've never seen them. It's not that they're there, it's that they're just not accounted for. And it's Rumsfeld that's driving this because he's got this theorem that he learned at Princeton. You probably heard it. The absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Don't you guys wish you went to Princeton? Okay. So, text draw, the British Foreign Minister objects. And then Sir Richard Dearlove says this famous sentence, but the intelligence and facts are being fixed around the policy. Remember, this is the 23rd of July, 2002, 8 months before the war, 3 months before there was any intelligence estimate on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and 2 months before they went to Congress to seek permission for the war. So we know, it's documentary proof. The minutes were written by a participant the same day as the meeting, and the British government has vouched for its authenticity, so you don't have to argue with your friends anymore, just show them the Downing Street minutes. There's another thing that many of you probably haven't heard. I go around and I ask people, and most people haven't. The CIA is justifiably criticized for not having a lot of human sources inside Iraq, agents, spies, and that's justified. But we had one that made up for the others. Does anyone know the fellow that I'm referring to?
Who was it?
Pardon?
Curveball?
A curveball. This is a sick joke, right? Well, for the administration's purposes, yeah, he made up for a lot, right? Yeah, he was the guy that told us about the bioweapons laboratories, which were invented out of thin air. Now, I'm referring to the And listen, folks, to the Iraqi foreign minister, we had turned him in intelligence jargon, but that means we had gone to all kinds of risks. I say we, these my former colleagues, they had called in all kinds of chips, they had laid out all kinds of money, and they turned the Iraqi foreign minister in place. So he was no longer working for Saddam Hussein, he was working for us. And he was telling us all manner of interesting things. And when this happened, my colleagues, former colleagues, were very pleased, and they told the White House, you know, we have a really good source I want to tell you about. I think maybe even the president would be interested in hearing about this. And so they were invited down the next day. Afternoon, they're there, president's there. And they report that this source had just told us lots of things that the ones we could check out, we have, and they did check out. And he also told us there aren't any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That was precisely the reaction. Stony silence. My friends couldn't believe it. They briefed him on some of the other things he said, but it was clear that there was no enthusiasm for what this fellow had to say. And so they said, well, I guess we'll end the briefing. And they started walking out, and they asked Andy Card, who was the chief of staff, said to Mr. Card, do you want to hear more from the source? And he said, well, thanks, but no thanks. It's not about weapons of mass destruction, it's about regime change. Okay. So I stress, this is the same time as the Downing Street memos, around that same time, the middle of 2002. So if you want confirmation of that, go to 60 Minutes and look up Tyler Drumheller. He was the head of the division in the CIA that recruited and turned the Iraqi foreign minister. On the other major issue, Al-Qaeda, the imagined ties between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, that you also know is rubbish, it always was. And on this, my former colleagues hung tough. No matter how many times the vice president visited CIA headquarters, they refused to bend and say, yeah, there are significant ties between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. The implication, of course, was that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. And maybe you don't know this, but 69% of the American people believed when we attacked Iraq that Saddam Hussein played some sort of role in 9/11. And 85% of the military, our military in Iraq, believed that and still do because they were brainwashed to believe that before they went out. So, what's the documentary proof now? Well, Pat Roberts, the arch loyalist of the administration, senator from Kansas, head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has finally issued a 2.5-year study which says, in a couple of words, there never were, there never are, there aren't any ties between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, and even this fellow Zarqawi. Some of you may remember that Rumsfeld raised Zarqawi with me when I had a chance to interrogate him there in Atlanta. So while Zarqawi was in Iraq, the truth is, as this study shows, that as soon as Saddam Hussein found out that Zarqawi was in Iraq, he did his best to send his minions out to arrest the guy, apprehend him, and put him out of commission. So there never were any meaningful ties between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. And so as we watched all this, we kept writing, and our second memo before the war was called Cooking Intelligence for War, another technical intelligence term, cooking intelligence, the recipe of high policy. That's the cardinal sin of intelligence analysis. You don't do that, you never do that. If you're gonna do that, you might as well not have an intelligence agency. The third thing we did three before the war, the title was Forgery, Hyperbole, and Half-Truth. You've got a problem, Mr. President. Now, those were all published before the war, and you're gonna have to take my word for it. Henry Waxman wrote a letter to the president before the war saying, look, I voted for this war last fall, and I voted for it on the basis of what your people are now telling me was a forgery. How can this happen? That was the famous story about Iraq seeking uranium in the African country of Niger. So we were, I don't know how to explain it, there's no English word for it. Outrage doesn't do it. We were outraged at what was happening to our profession, seeing it politicized, seeing it corrupted, but we're even more outraged I mentioned conservative before. Most of us are pretty conservative folks, worked for the CIA. I was an Army officer as well. And especially when it comes to the Constitution of the United States, which we take an oath to defend against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And we saw our profession being corrupted for the express purpose of tricking the legislative branch, our elected representatives in the Congress, out of their constitutional prerogative to declare or authorize war. Well, that was even worse than seeing your profession prostituted. That was a constitutional crisis. And we can see the things that flow from that. Niger, this business of Iraq seeking uranium in Niger. That was the Vice President's favorite theme because it was the only thing that could associate Iraq with a nuclear program. The report was false on its face. When the in early 2002, when the analysts got a hold of it and saw, so Iraq is seeking yellow cake uranium in Niger, then they may have a deal. Well, the analysts knew that Niger doesn't control the yellow cake uranium mine there. It's all controlled by an international consortium headed by the French. There's no way in God's heaven that Saddam Hussein or anyone else could siphon off some of that uranium. And besides, the analysts also knew that Saddam Hussein has tons and tons of yellow cake uranium in country, like in Iraq. The problem was not getting it. The problem was refining it to a higher grade of uranium. And so the analysts just threw the thing in the circular file. And there go my notes. And still the Vice President insisted, thanks, that this would be very, very interesting, and that's why Joe Wilson, of course, was sent down to Niger, you know, the rest of that story. That was what they used with Congress. And, you know, it was, some of you are old enough to remember The King and I with Yul Brynner, you know. It reminded me of that time when Yul Brynner gets up and he says, "So, it's a false lie." I mean, that's what we had here, something false on its face, based on a forgery. The other thing was the National Intelligence Estimate. This pains me to tell you about this, because I used to chair these things, and we used to take great care to make sure they came out honest and as accurate as we could make them. But none was done during this whole period when people were advertising that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. George Tenet, the head of the CIA, avoided doing an estimate like the plague. Why? Because an honest estimate would have said, beats the hell out of us. I mean, we know that 90% of the weapons of mass destruction were destroyed right after the war. I mean, Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, who was in charge of those programs, told us that and verified it. The other 10% could be an accounting error. We've never seen any of these things, you know. And Don Rumsfeld's theorem about no evidence does ever. How did that go? I didn't go to Princeton. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. We don't buy that, you know. And yet, they were told. Well, what happened was after they got together after the summer of 2002, and they had this council of war and said, "What do we do?" Well, first thing we have to do is, Mr. President, you know, there's this Constitution thing. What do you mean, Constitution thing? Well, literally, sir, you don't really. Well, let me put it this way. Technically speaking, the Congress is got under the law, you know, under this war, the Congress has the power to declare war or authorize war. So you ought to do what your daddy did and, you know, go to the Congress and persuade them to authorize this war. No problem. Let's do it. And, well, there is a problem, Mr. President, because we don't really have the evidence to persuade Congress. What do you mean? How about the chemical and biological warfare things? Well, the DIA, those wimps over there in the Defense Intelligence Agency, have just put out a memo, September 2002, saying there's no good evidence they have any weapons like this, chemical or biological weapons, and there's certainly no evidence that they can fabricate them, that they can make them. So if you do that, then they'll pull the rug out from under you. Well, how about ties between Al-Qaeda and Iraq? Well, those wimps over at the CIA don't buy that, and Congress knows that, so we can't use that either. Well, what we use? Someone would have suggested, well, we have that report. that Iraq is seeking uranium in the African country of Niger, let's use that. Now, Tenet no doubt was there, and he would have said, well, we found out that was sort of false on its face, and also it's based on forgery, but I'll bet that Cheney said, well, who knows him? And I said, well, nobody knows. The UN has gotten the drift of this, but we haven't given it to you. Well, how long can you keep it from the UN? Well, probably a couple more months. Well, what's the problem? Well, you said. Now, you know, some of you are thinking, how did they possibly think they could get away with that? Huh? It was pretty easy, you know. We'll use this report to deceive the Congress, and a couple other reports like bogus aluminum tubes for artillery, and that Condoleezza Rice said was for uranium enrichment. We'll use all this, we'll have our war, we'll defeat Saddam Hussein handily, because he's got no armed forces. We will have removed a brutal dictator. We'll be sitting pretty in Baghdad, dominating all the oil which we will have preserved as we attack, and the oil ministry will still be intact. And we will have made that area even safer for the country of Israel, and we'll have we'll have enduring military bases there. And you know, tell me, now you just tell me, who's going to come at that point? Who's going to come and say, yeah, what you did it on the basis of a forgery. Give me a break. We'll be sitting high. It's going to be a cakewalk. And besides, of course, the people are going to greet us with open arms and cut flowers. Someone said to me, you know, Ray, that shows that there just proves the adage, there's no such thing as a perfect crime. You know, we bollocksed it up so much, and it was inevitable anyway, that there were no hearts, open hearts and cut flowers and all that kind of stuff. And so the whole thing unraveled, and that's where we are today. There was one happy story out of all this. My wife tells me, don't criticize Colin Powell. Criticize his behavior. Well, his behavior was a profound disappointment to me. I know the fellow. He grew up a mile from me in the Bronx. He was a year ahead of me in school. I know, you know, we both come from immigrant families. I know the syndrome. And to watch him, you know, pass up the opportunity to change things, to speak out with a little courage, both on torture and on the war itself, just as a profound disappointment. There was one kind of hopeful light out of the whole thing, and that was Colin Powell's intelligence analysts. The ones that he conveniently forgot to bring with him to CIA headquarters during those famous 4 days and four nights that he brags about spending at CIA headquarters before his speech on the 5th of February 2003. He didn't bring them with us. Why? Because they were still telling the truth. It's very difficult to predict the culmination of a program that you haven't, that you're not persuaded has been started. What do you mean? Well, we mean that, we know that the Vice President has said that Saddam Hussein has reignited his nuclear weapons development program, but that's not good enough for us. That's sort of like faith-based intelligence. We don't see the evidence, okay? And so we're not gonna be able to say how soon he can have a nuclear weapon. And of course, there are diplomats there, so they construct an erudite footnote, which was a page long, which said that in diplomatic terms. That reminded me at the time of a cartoon that my daughter, our middle daughter, sent us from the University of Virginia, where she was majoring in history. It was a BC cartoon, you know? And the father was standing up on a rock with a loincloth on, and he's holding this tablet, and his daughter is cringing before him, and it's very clear that this tablet is a report card, okay, a rock thing. And his caption says, oh, great, history, F. You flunked something, didn't even happen yet. So the State Department was being asked to predict the end of a program, didn't even happen. We know now that it was not reignited, and that Saddam Hussein's son-in-law was telling us exactly the right case in 1995. And some of you may not know that someone leaked that debriefing report to Newsweek magazine 8 weeks before the war started. And what did Newsweek do? They put it in their little periscope thing, you know, like two paragraphs, three paragraphs. It had a small report in the Baltimore Sun, and none of the other mainstream media even mentioned it, just to show you what the cheerleading to the war prohibited in terms of real real reporting. So, we found ourselves being really, really angry. And, you know, where I come from in the Bronx, you were, at least in my day, you were allowed to be angry for a day, maybe 2 days. If you were Irish, they'd give you a week, you know. But I found myself angry all the time. And luckily, I remember something I learned at Fordham, the college where I went to. And we had to study a lot of Thomas Aquinas at Fordham, so much so that our Catholic college colleagues, or other colleges, called us peeping Thomists. It was a little overdone. I mean, Thomas was good about some things, about things he didn't know about, like women and stuff like that. It was pretty horrendous. But he was good on virtue, okay? And he complained bitterly, as he wrote about virtue, that there was no, that the word for the virtue of anger, I repeat, the word for the virtue of anger, manati nominata, remains unnamed, okay? So he brought the old Pythagorean idea that virtue's in the middle, so too much of something you don't like, little is no good either. Take courage, for example, that's just enough of what you need, that's the virtue. Foolhardiness, no good. Timidity, no good. Well, Thomas said, there's no word in Latin, language in which he wrote, for the virtue of anger. So we went back to the 4th century church, John Chrysostom, father of the church, who wrote, he or she who is not angry when there is just cause for anger sins. Why? Because anger respicit bonum justitiae. Anger looks to the good of justice, and if you can live amid injustice without anger, you are unjust. Thomas is always pleased to get a fresh ovation. It's been 800 years. He added his own little corollary to that, and this is really telling, and I think all too appropriate for us to ponder. He railed against what he called unreasoned patience. That's the best translation we do from the Latin. Unreasoned patience. Think about that, what that might mean, folks. He said that unreasoned patience sows the seeds of vice, nourishes negligence, and encourages not only evil people, but good people to do evil. What we're talking about is a supreme evil. If we take 5 steps back, we have a war of aggression, which Nuremberg, after World War II, defined this way. To initiate a war of aggression is the supreme international crime, differing from other war crimes only insofar as it contains the accumulated evils of the whole. Now, what could those accumulated evils be, folks? Torture, maybe? Rendition? Kidnapping people, putting them in black holes without telling their wives or their children or the Red Cross? Playing fast and loose with U.S. criminal law? Eavesdropping on us, Americans, without a court warrant required by law? I mean, there's an endless list now. Many of this has been legalized by the so-called Military Commissions Act. But those are the evils, those are the accumulated evils. And I'd just like to say a couple of words about one or two of them. This reminds me of the first time I was asked to speak after the war started, the first week of the war. I happened to be on Amy Goodman one morning, and I got a call from the professor who was running the teaching at American University the next day, and he said, would you speak? I said, what do you want me to speak about? He said, well, about the lies that led up to this war. And without thinking, I said, well, how much time do I have? And he said, 10 minutes. And I said, well, it's going to be difficult, but I'll just pick the top 15, you know. Well, that's how I feel about the accumulated evils. I mean, it's an endless list, folks. And we've sort of had a lot of unrestrained patience. And let's talk a little bit more of that in a second. But I do want to talk about torture because we have a, you know, we have a trail on that. We know who authorized torture. Torture isn't to be blamed on the rotten apples at the bottom of the barrel. The rotten apples were at the very top of the barrel, folks, and it's documentarily proven. On the night of 9/11, after the president gave his address to the nation, he came down into a separate room, actually, it was the bunker, with Don Rumsfeld and Richard Clark. How do we know this? Richard Clark has it in his book. And he said, look, this is different. All the gloves are off. And when international law was mentioned, according to Clark, the president bit off the head of whoever mentioned international law, saying, in Clark quotes, I don't care what the international lawyers say, we're going to kick some ass. Okay. Now, what happens next? Well, I wasn't there, but it's pretty easy to reconstruct. The next day or two, he calls the head of the CIA in and says, look, we're going to capture a lot of people in Afghanistan. We're going first, then we're going to Iraq, and we're going to have the gloves taken off. We're going to interrogate these people and just squeeze whatever information we can get out of them. Do you have some folks there at the CIA that can do this? And George Tenet, my dad, said, well, I'll check, and came back a couple days later and said, yeah, we have about 15, 16 people that volunteer to do this. They have some experience in Vietnam in this area, and they know contractors that do this, and so they can arrange for it. But of course, Mr. President, you know, they'd like you to sign this finding. A finding is what the president needs to sign before he allows or orders the CIA to do this kind of skullduggery. Okay, so the president looks at it and says, Alberto, get Gonzalez in here. Yes, Mr. President. Alberto, can I sign this? No, oh, Mr. President, give me a day or two. I'll consult and I'll be back to you. Okay, guess who he goes to? Vice President's lawyer, David Addington. He says, can we sign this thing? And Addington says, you came to the right place. We have people working at the Department of Justice on this very, we'll give you a memo in 2 days. And on the 25th of January, 2002, comes that famous memo signed by Gonzalez, but drafted by Addington, which says, Geneva's quaint and obsolete. You don't have to worry about Geneva. You can exempt the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from Geneva protections. But Mr. President, there is this US domestic law, actually it's called War Crimes Act, passed by the Newt Gingrich Republican-dominated Congress in 1996. And unfortunately, it ties the Geneva protections to US criminal law. It's 18 US Code 2441, and we can't rule out that in the future some mean-spirited special prosecutor could be appointed to pursue you for violating that law. But, wonderful lawyerly language, quote, there is a reasonable basis in law where you can escape any prosecution for that. Now, my friends, does that sound like a mafia lawyer to you? And on the strength of that, 13 days later, on the 7th of February, the president signed an executive order in which he parroted the language that David Addington gave him and said, we don't have to give Al-Qaeda or the Taliban Geneva's protections, but we will treat them, quote, humanely, comma, as appropriate, comma, and as consistent with military necessity, period, end quote. My friends, that is the loophole through which Don Rumsfeld and George Tenet drove the Mack truck of officially sanctioned torture. And so, again, the rotten apples were not at the bottom of the barrel, they were demonstrably at the very top of the barrel. If you want the memo, just pick it off the URL for it. It's right up there, the 25 January memo and the 7 February memo. Colin Powell, where was he in all this? Well, he objected strenuously in a memo that said, Mr. President, this would reverse a whole century of U.S. Army tradition. This would introduce ambiguities in the status of prisoners of war. This would have a terrible effect on the morale of the armed forces. Okay. But he said that on the 26th of January. And Addington and Gonzalez knew this, what he thought, so that's why they wrote their memo on the 25th. So it's doubtful that the president ever saw Powell's memo, the more so since Powell chose to have his lawyer talk to the president's lawyer. And I fault Powell for this because he knew better. He should have marched right into the White House. I mean, he owed his whole career to this army, his whole position in life. And if he didn't have the strength of his conviction to say torture is beyond the pale, Mr. President, and he didn't. So that's how it got underway, and we know the rest of the story. We know how they tried to justify it, and we know that even now we have the vice president saying waterboarding. That's a no-brainer. Of course, waterboarding. I should probably be precise in quoting this because it's very, very revealing. He was interviewed by a fellow named Scott Hennin, who is described as a conservative talk show host in North Dakota. He told Cheney that listeners had asked him to, quote, let the vice president know that if it takes dunking a terrorist in water, we're all for it if it saves American lives, period, end quote. So the interviewer says to Cheney, again, this debate seems a little silly given the threat we face. Wouldn't you agree? I do agree, says Cheney. Would you agree that a dunk in the water is a no-brainer if it can save lives? Lives, asks Hennin. It's a no-brainer for me, but we don't torture. Now, on the 6th of September, the very day that the President of the United States got up before a press conference and in an unseemly way advertised and praised the effects of torture, the CIA program, the enhanced interrogation techniques that allowed us to learn about Abu Zubaydah and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who told us about blah, blah, blah. Most of that was out and out wrong. We learned that stuff from other sources. So, number one, it was wrong. Number two, how incongruous this is. The president was asking for permission to torture people. At the same time, on the same day, the head of Army Intelligence, Lieutenant General John Simmons, or Timmons, was saying this, and I quote, no good intelligence is going to come from abusive practices. I think history tells us that. I think the empirical evidence of the last 5 years, comma, hard years, comma, tells us that, end quote. It's a gratuitous swipe at the President of the United States. See, the Army had decided that it benefits everybody, including the Army, to adhere to the Geneva protections, okay? And they just issued a manual that day, which outlawed waterboarding, among other things, explicitly, okay? And now we have Cheney and the others bragging about it. It's most unseemly, and I've never seen the light of it. Now, torture can work. And the administration had a real coup when they captured, in early 2002, a fellow named Ad al-Libi, who was fairly high up in the al-Qaeda hierarchy. And he said that he knew a good bit about what al-Qaeda was all about and all that stuff. And so they gave him to the Egyptians and told the Egyptians, you know, we think he might know about how Saddam Hussein was training al-Qaeda. And he might, you know, have a lot of spicy information. So see what you can do. And surprise, surprise, the Egyptians found out that He reported under torture that yes, indeed, Saddam Hussein was providing trainers to al-Qaeda, was training them in explosives and all kinds of other things, just what the doctor ordered for the president's speech 3 days before he asked Congress to approve the war. And Colin Powell's speech on the 5th of February, they included the information from this fellow, even though the Defense Intelligence Agency had issued a report disclaiming the validity of this, because they found out, of course, surprise, surprise, that the fellow was tortured. He disavowed this. He said, hey, yeah, I said that's not true. I did it under torture. But what a great thing it was for the administration to be able to adduce that evidence. So in that sense, and in only that sense, you can get torture to work for you. Pretty cynical, huh? Well, where are we going to go with all this? I guess I just say that the only break on the President of the United States, the only restraint, comes in oversight from Congress. And for the last 6 years, this has been a sick joke. With the President's party controlling the House and Intelligence Committees, House and Senate Intelligence Committees, it's been a sick joke. These folks, it's not the oversight committees, they're the overlook committees. Pat Roberts and this fellow Pete Hoekstra, he's the guy that helped Rick Santorum find the weapons of mass destruction. Remember, 5 weeks ago, we found them. We were right all along. We found 500 aging canisters of mustard gas left over from the Iraq-Iran war, and they found the weapons of mass destruction. Not even Cheney and Rumsfeld would support that. That's the kind. Now, Hoekstra was in on that, and this was a big hoax, right? And he's head of the House Intelligence Committee. He's the fellow that I gave back my intelligence commendation award to. That's how bad it is. So without that, now, You know, there's a representative around here somewhere who sits on the Homeland Security Oversight Committee. They just got a report card. The average grade was D- of what they've been able to achieve. And the congressional overseers are sat by while all the money goes out to Iraq to build prisons and stuff like that, and our chemical plants especially, and other vulnerable pieces of real estate here are pretty much ignored. So oversight is a joke as long as you have the overseers of the same party and not responsible people, not people with integrity, but people who are party hacks. Military Commissions Act. I don't know if your representative signed that thing, but if he or she did, you ought to hold that person accountable. That is more properly called the Enabling Act, because it's a dead ringer. It's a carbon copy of the act that Hitler prevailed upon his Congress, the German Parliament, to pass in 1933 after their 9/11, the burning of their Parliament building. That's what Hitler used. He intimidated their legislators, and they were so cowardly that they went up and gave Hitler the dictatorial powers that allowed him to do the rest of it. Now, I was born at the end of August in 1939, a week before Hitler drove his tanks into Poland and started World War II. And so I had a special interest in that period. I lived in Germany for 5 years, and I had all kinds of opportunity to ask Germans, young and old, how could it be, how could it possibly be that you, among the most educated, most cultivated people in the Western world, could sit by silently and watch Hitler do all this quite legally, not hold your parliamentarians, your congressmen accountable, and just sort of kind of show unreasoned patience to the ninth degree, you know? And I never got a satisfactory answer to that. But the parallels, my friends, are really, really striking. There's one book that's particularly helpful in this. It's called Defying Hitler by Sebastian Hafner. Anybody read that? It didn't get much play in this country, but it was a big sensation in Germany about 10 years ago. This is really the contemporary notes, sort of an autobiography of sorts, of a young lawyer who spent the 20s and 30s in Germany and kept these notes. His son found them about 20 years ago, translated them. And this is what I'd just like to refer to a little bit of what he says, because it's so relevant. The Reichstag burned down, German parliament, and of course Hitler immediately blamed terrorists. These terrorists were communists, but they were terrorists first and foremost, that was the word used, and because of these terrorists, let me read you what Hafner says. I don't see that one can blame the majority of Germans who in 1933 believed that the Reichstag fire was the work of terrorists, communists. What one can blame them for, and what shows their terrible collective weakness of character, is that that settled the matter. With sheepish submissiveness, the German people accepted that, as a result of the fire, each one of them lost what little personal freedom and dignity was guaranteed to them by their constitution. As though it followed as a necessary consequence. If the communists had burned down the Reichstag, it was perfectly in order that the government would take, quote, decisive measures, end quote. He got into the office the day after the fire, and his colleagues, his other lawyers, were discussing, you know, the government's explanation of what happened and so forth. And he asked them if they saw anything out of the ordinary in the fact that their telephones would thence be tapped, their letters opened, and their desks broke into. And they said, no, we don't see much problem. That's what we're going to have to tolerate. And they said, well, on my way in here, I noticed that all the communist literature had been taken off the newsstands. There were no kiosks where you could buy any communist literature, and the hall was very apparent because they usually occupied about a third of the newsstand. And I resent that, you know. He said, I think we should be able to read what we want to read. And you know what his colleague lawyer said? Oh? For how long have you been reading communist literature? What do you find in that? What do you think you need to... We don't need to read... That's very odd that you'd be reading communist literature. It's the same reaction I get going around the country asking people, don't you mind if your telephones are bugged? Your conversations listened to, your email? And you know what they say? I'm not talking with Al-Qaeda. You know? That doesn't bother me any. You know? So it's the same sort of syndrome. So I usually ask them, well, does it bother you that Arlen Specter's telephone is tapped? And most of them say, well, who's Arlen Specter? You know, when I tell them that he's head of the Senate Judiciary Committee and his purview over these things, they say, well, why do you say that? Well, you may recall that when it became revealed in December of last year that the president had authorized this illegal program, he bragged about authorizing it 30 times, in direct violation of criminal law, the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978. When it became known about that, well, Arlen Specter was in high dudgeon. He said, this cannot be. This is extra legal. We're going to pursue this. I'm going to hold hearings. And he held hearings the next month, in January, and he got Alberto Gonzalez in front. He said, now, Attorney General, you may proceed. And Pat Leahy, the ranking Democrat, said, well, Senator Specter, you forgot to swear the witness in. And Specter said, no, we're not going to swear him in. We swore him in 2 weeks ago, and we just decided we don't have to swear him in. And I'm sitting there saying, get up, and leave. This is a travesty of justice. Get up and leave. And of course, none of the Democrats heard me, and none of them left. But that was the first sign. Now, to make a long story short, 7 months later, here's Arlen Specter sponsoring a bill that gives President full liberty to do this kind of thing without any court order, and is this great country or what? Makes it retroactive. You know, holds the president harmless for having violated not only the Fourth Amendment, but U.S. criminal law, the FISA law of 1978. Now, why did Arlen Specter change his mind? Well, I emphasize that what I'm going to say now is speculative. Two FBI agents visited Senator Specter. They always come in twos. And they said, Senator, thanks for receiving us. We just want to tell you that we had a wonderful weekend with Mary Crawford in Cleveland. What a wonderful woman she is. You know, it was just really fun getting to know her. And she told us about your relationship. And we know that you go to Cleveland every weekend from your travel records. And we just got to thinking, who has to know about Mary Crawford? I mean, after all. But the president has this bill that's going to catch a lot of tourists. And he'd really like you to sponsor it, because that would be the death knell for all these liberals. You know, if you sponsored this with your strong stance against it, so could you do this? And then, you know, who has to know about Mary Crawford? Now, I see some of you back there saying, well, the government's gone off his rocker, and it's gone too far. But my friends, this is precisely why the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was drafted and passed in 1978. J. Edgar Hoover and others used to do this all the time, not only to senators and representatives, but to presidents, to Martin Luther King, to anybody else that was up for grabs. Okay? That's why they passed the law. And they made that law flexible enough to let it be used to catch foreign espionage agents as well. So it's a cockamamie excuse that the law is too restrictive. As a matter of fact, you know, let's take them at their word. Let's say that this program that they want to introduce, which included monitoring of American citizens, that it was would be too cumbersome under the existing law to do it. Well, then why didn't they change the law? But put yourself back to the immediate aftermath of 9/11. I have a friend that says you could have put a guillotine on every street corner in this country and nobody would have objected. I mean, look what we got. We got the Patriot Act within a couple of weeks. In that atmosphere, Congress would have given approval to any modification of FISA that was reasonable. And when Alberto Gonzalez was asked at a press conference on December 19th, after this became leaked about this program, he was asked by a correspondent, well, Mr. Attorney General, why did you do this end run around Congress? Why did you backdoor the thing? Why didn't you just go and have the law changed? You know what he said? He said, well, actually, we did go to Congress. We checked out with certain congressmen and senators, and they told us that it would be very difficult. Now, they told us it would be impossible to get a law like that approved. The press missed that, folks, but there it is. I've got the transcript. What does that tell you about this program? What does it tell you about the intrusiveness, the all-encompassing nature of this program that's being directed at us as well as other people? Well, so much for the eavesdropping thing and for torture. You can talk more about it if you'd like. You'd like to be depressed further. What's going on now? Well, some of you know about my conversation with Rumsfeld in Atlanta in early May, where I had a chance to... Somebody, a correspondent, asked me the other day, would I declare what I thought about whether Rumsfeld should be fired? And I said, well, you know, fair labeling here. I owe Rumsfeld a lot. I'm not sure I can be completely objective, since he made me a folk hero for two news cycles. But I overcame that and said, sure, he should be fired. He should be fired yesterday. Anyhow, the reason I refer to that is some of you will remember the fellow with the black hat. I mean, he actually had a black hat and a white shirt, and he came down when I asked about the weapons of mass destruction, saying, you know, you said you knew where they were, and he very sneakily put himself behind me. The CNN camera was behind us, and so nobody could see what he's doing, but he put his elbow in my solar plexus and was easing me away from the microphone. And that's when I said, oh, this is America. And do you remember Rumsfeld standing up there?
Yeah.
And he had a split-second judgment. Does he let me get carried out? Not for heckling him, mind you, but for asking him two substantive questions, to both of which he had lied? Or does he let me stay? And he makes his answer, no. I'll let him stay for a second. And I can see what he's thinking. I'm not only a star philosopher from Princeton with my new adages, but I'm a great debater, and who is this guy? You know, so bring him on, you know. Now, the reason I mention that is because now, if that happened now, I am convinced that the guy in the black hat and three others would have carried me right out of there. Why? Because now it's about intimidation, folks. This is all very deliberate. When Cheney says waterboarding is a no-brainer, that's intimidation, folks. That's meant to scare us all. That's meant to, you know, it's a different kind of campaign now. No more Mr. Nice Guy. Whoever was any nice guy. And they're counting on our sheepish submissiveness. There was one German who rose to the occasion. Actually, there were a couple, but one we all know is Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Lutheran pastor who did try to speak out and form a confessing church. This was the most depressing thing of all, of course. Where were the German churches? Why could the Catholic Church, why could the Lutheran Church not find their voices? This was going on, and they're very similar situations. Now, where are our churches? Where are they talking about? Just, you know, why are they silent? Anyhow, there was a fellow named Albrecht Haushofer, and he was a Geologe. He was a geologist at the University of Berlin, and he had tenure. Some of you know what that means, tenure. Okay, so he had pretty much made. And he had tenure because he kept his mouth shut. When Hitler started invading other countries and wrapping up household for his Jewish friends, he decided that he had a conscience, and that spoke to him and prompted him to speak out. And he spoke out very strongly and acquired quite a following around him. So he was wrapped up by the SS, put in a separate prison from Bonhoeffer, and condemned to be shot. Now, the SS was very methodical, and they insisted that before they shoot you or hang you, you had to sign your confession. Confess and sign a confession. And Haushofer refused to do it, so they got so angry they shot him. Anyway, as they picked him up off the floor, out of his pocket falls this little zettel, this little piece of paper on which he had written his confession. It's brief. I'd like to recite it for you, and then I'll translate it. Schuld. Any of you know German? Schuld, okay. Guilt, right? Doch. Bin ich schuldig, aber anders als ihr denkt. Yeah, I'm guilty, but it's not what you're thinking. Ich musste früher, earlier, I should have earlier Ich musste früher meine Pflicht erkennen. I should have earlier recognized my duty. Ich musste schärfer Unheil, Unheil nennen. Unheil is evil, okay? Schärfer is more sharply. So, I should have more sharply called evil, evil. Mein Urteil habe ich zu lang gelenkt. I put off my judgment far too long. Ich habe gewarnt, I did warn, aber nicht genug. Genug. Enough. Und klar. Claro, clear, okay? So, I did warn, but not enough and clearly enough. Ich habe gewarnt, aber nicht genug und klar. Und heute weiß ich, was ich schuldig war. And today I recognize what I was guilty of. There is such a thing as too late, folks. And we just said about that period, I am convinced. There comes a time when we have to do other things than we've been doing. There's a time when we need to put our bodies into it. There's a time when we have to stand up and not be guilty of unreasoned patience. And I think this is that time. We've got about a week to work to do this in an orderly way. I hope that you all can recognize the folks that voted for this fascist legislation. This legislation that makes a mockery of our Bill of Rights and the constitutional protections that we have all enjoyed up till now. And I hope we can be enlightened enough and courageous enough and active enough in this next week to turn those people out and put people in who have a respect for our rights, respect for our constitution, because there is such a thing as too late. And the poet Dante, you know, famously said, the hottest fires in hell are reserved for those who in times of crisis remain neutral. Now, just to finish up here, you should know that I Googled hell yesterday, okay? And I found out that it was 10 degrees hotter in hell yesterday than it was in Crawford, Texas in August. And I can testify that's pretty hot. So let's let that be an admonition to all of us. Let's eschew this unrestrained patience or unreasoned patience. Let's act like patriots and not like sheepish, submissive Germans, because we don't have a lot of time left to make sure we turn this around. Thanks very much.